Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We take your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith or anything else remotely related to those things. And if you'd like to call and ask such a question, I'll give you a phone number for that. You can also call if you want to disagree with the host, if you've heard the show before, or if in the course of listening to the program today, you hear something today that you disagree with. You can always call to balance comment. Now, I say you can always call, but that means when we have lines open, and we don't at the moment. But let me give you the number anyway, because within a few minutes, as the program progresses, there will be lines opening up, and you can get through. I guarantee sometime before the hour is over, if you try, there will be sometimes the lines are open. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Timothy from Ontario, California. And Timothy, good to hear from you again. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great, Steve. How you been?
Good. Hey, we met you once at one of our meetings in Temecula, right?
Yeah, and I've been trying to get out there, and I haven't been able to, and I've seen that you're going to be out in Arizona, Buckeye, I think.
Yeah.
And my wife and I are actually looking to move to Arizona. I've been praying about that, either Buckeye or Surprise, wanting to get out of California. But
maybe you ought to go down there on vacation that weekend, yeah. Look at places.
My question, Steve, is I'm looking at the word trust in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, and the way it's used in the Old Testament often is, in many ways, but my question is, in the Old Testament, you see it used as, put your trust in the Lord, I will trust in the Lord, trust in the Lord with all your heart, but in the New Testament, you don't see that phrase being used, and I was wondering, why is that so? You don't see that phrase, even though it might be alluded to. But that word, the phrasing of putting your trust in the Lord in the New Testament is not really seen. It's only in the Old Testament.
Yeah, and as far as answering that, I can only give a guess about that. And it may very well be because the word faith in the New Testament, pistis in the Greek, is a much broader word than our word faith. And it would include things like trust. And certainly we see Jesus saying, have faith in God, which would be the same as saying trust in God. Or at least it would be included in that. Now, I'm not familiar as much with the Hebrew language. It may be that that in the Hebrew they have different words for different aspects of what the New Testament calls faith. And therefore you'd find a specific word for trust used independently in several places, which would be in really pretty much included in the Greek word for faith, which is, of course, very common in the New Testament.
Okay, yeah. I was thinking the same thing as I didn't have any of my tools with me to look it up, but this morning as I was thinking about what I was going to ask you, I'm thinking it must be because of faith. It must be that's why. But I just thought that was really interesting that you don't, even in my Vine's Expository Dictionary of Old and New Testament words, you don't find the word trust in the New Testament in that dictionary that I have. But if I use my Strong's Concordance, it's there, but it's never used as put your trust in the Lord or trust in the Lord with all your heart. It seems like there's a more love, faith-based driven in the New Testament as opposed to the Old Testament.
Yeah, I really think that the word faith in the New Testament not only does not exclude the idea of trusting, but I think trusting is one of the central meanings of it. I don't think that probably the Hebrew and the Greek language do not have the same flexibility in their words for faith, and so the Old Testament uses another word specifically for trust, although the word faith is found also, but also is the word believe and so forth. I mean, when we think about the word faith in the New Testament, it does talk about having confidence in, relying upon, trusting in, being faithful to, and believing. You know, I mean, all those things are part of what faith means in the New Testament. So I think trusting in God is very much a major part of that.
Right. It's there, but it's not used the way we see it in the Old Testament.
Maybe not the same phrase, yeah.
Right. I just thought that was interesting, and I was hoping, you know, and I pretty much came to the same conclusion that you did. I just wanted to hear, you know, I guess I wanted some confirmation on that.
Well, what I gave you is just an educated guess. I really haven't searched out that question myself, but that would be the first thing that comes to my mind that would fit reasonably what I do know.
Right. Okay, well, I appreciate your time, Steve. I'll let you get to your other callers.
Okay, Timothy, thanks for calling. Good to hear from you again.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, our next caller is Jeffrey from Los Angeles, California. Jeffrey, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for you. Something that has kind of been difficult for me since the beginning of my Christian walk is the kind of the amount of difference, I guess, within the church and, I guess, along denominational lines. And I've heard a couple of your lectures on that I think they've offered some really helpful antidotes on how to kind of deal with that. And, you know, especially when it comes to, like, different types of teaching and things like that. But I wanted to get your perspective on what do you think, how do you see the church kind of in the near future or even distant future when it comes to coming together, you know, coming together for fellowship, I guess just church. Because it seems to be, it's a little challenging the way I perceive it to kind of know how things are going to manifest themselves. I mean, I know we're not to know everything, but and even in a sense, if you could actually answer this, I think it's kind of related. This whole movement about, I guess some call it the emergent watch or the emergent church, and some Christians kind of pointing out, I think, being overly critical of, you know, what other Christians or other churches are doing. What would you say about all that?
Well, you're kind of asking me to make a prediction about something that I don't have a special knowledge of, about what the church will look like, you know, as it develops in the future. I can see certain trajectories which may continue, and if they do, there may be something predictable about the way things will look, but trajectories can change, and so it's hard to really know for sure. But I can say in the long term, and this may not be in our lifetimes, but eschatologically, the Bible indicates that the church will come, as Paul puts it, in the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God unto a mature man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, and that we will be no longer children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine. So we're going to, and he goes on to say, we're going to all grow up into all things into Christ, who is the head. Now, that the church will someday, as Paul says, be unified, will come into the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God unto a mature man. By the way, he deliberately uses the singular, a mature man, for the church, because he sees the church as the body of Christ. And at this point, of course, an immature and imperfect body of Christ, but one that is supposed to grow up, just like Jesus himself, when he was born on the world, was not immediately mature. It says in Luke chapter 2 that the boy Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and men. And so also, I believe the body of Christ has got to grow up into a mature man also. Now, Paul in Ephesians 2, just two chapters earlier, spoke of how God took the Jewish believer and the Gentile believer, removed the middle wall of partition between them, and made in himself one new man. That is, the body of Christ, of course, is the one new man made of Jews and Gentiles in Christ. And Paul now says, now we're going to come unto a mature man at some point. This body is going to be mature. And he says this will be characterized by our coming in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, and growing up in all things into him who is the head, and being no more children tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. These are things that Paul sees as the ultimate destiny of the church, and I dare say that we may not live to see it, but if we were living in the generation where this was going to happen, and perhaps we are, then someday we could say the church will be no longer bickering, no longer making mountains out of molehills, no longer dividing over things of secondary and tertiary importance, that the church will be comprised of all those who love and follow Jesus Christ faithfully, and they will love each other. And there will be, there may be some differences of opinion, but there will not be over the kinds of things that would separate them from each other. This unity is what Jesus prayed for, and I don't think his prayer has been answered yet, so it must be still ahead. In John chapter 17, Jesus prayed, "Father, I pray that they who you've given me," he says, "I pray that they may be one, so that the world may know that you have sent me." Well, the world does not yet know that God has sent Jesus, so I suppose we have not yet become one in the sense that he prayed for. But since he prayed for it, and Jesus always prayed in faith and according to the will of God, that will eventually happen. And Paul seems to see it happening, too, in the future. Now, I don't know if that'll happen in our time. If you're looking for an answer about what the church will look like in the foreseeable future, given the trajectory of things at the moment, I'm not a futurist who would have the ability to, you know, track these things perfectly. But it looks to me that one thing that may happen is that the church will experience a certain polarization between what we call the institutional churches and the organic churches. That's already happening, and it may become more so. Now, institutional churches, you know, they have some merits and so forth, but there's a lot of people who are finding them inadequate as places of discipleship, as places of, just expressing the body of Christ and so forth. And in many cases, it's the institutionalization of the churches that has prevented them from being unified. And whereas a lot of times, the people who are hungrier for maybe a more spiritual expression of their faith are looking for organic expressions of fellowship, sometimes in home groups, sometimes not in homes, but somewhere else, but without the institutional trap of trying to build a big congregation, trying to get money, trying to have big buildings, trying to impress the world, or even to compete with other churches for their size and so forth, which is so common in churches, in the institutional churches. Now, I'm not saying that organic churches are perfect. Far from it. But I do think that the organic churches, which do meet in homes and other places, are largely populated with people who are, what should we say, more than average concerned about living the Christian life faithfully. I'm not saying that people in the institutional churches, that these churches don't have people who are equally interested in living the Christian life faithfully. I'm sure they do. But the institutional churches are also, havens for people who don't take Christianity very seriously. And therefore, it's a mixed multitude. And in the early church, the church was not set up to be a mixed multitude. It was set up to be a fellowship of people who are true disciples of Jesus, not just kind of a place for curiosity seekers and people who, you know, lived in sin but wanted to kind of come on Sunday to feel a little better about themselves, or people who aren't committed to Christ at all, but they do feel better, after all, when they hear a good sermon and sing some lively songs, or where they get more entertainment from the church than they get from somewhere else they might go on a Sunday morning. I guess the other option would be in their beds. But the point is, there are lots of kinds of people in the institutional church, including some who are very serious about their Christian walk, but including a lot who are not. And generally speaking, when people move out of those groups into more organic fellowships, it's because they are very serious about living the Christian life. They're very concerned that the institutional churches they're in are somehow inhibiting that, either for themselves or for their children. And they're looking for an alternative where they can meet with people who feel as they do, that Christianity is an all-consuming, all-defining life choice in reality. And so I see more and more of this happening, and it may happen. While I don't claim to be a prophet, A.W. Tozer sometimes saw himself as a prophet, and he made a prediction in a sermon that I heard on tape and I have it somewhere on my hard drive. I transcribed it. He said he foresees a time when the whole institutional churches will just be abandoned by all men of God and women of God who really care about God because of all the compromise that simply is inherent in the institutionalization. And he now, Tozer wasn't talking about organic churches. I'm not sure what he thought was going to happen because he lived, well, he died in the 60s, and we didn't have your home church movement that we have now then. But he actually said he can see a time when the you know, churches, the evangelical churches, he said, will not have one man of God in them anymore. Now, I don't know if he was right or wrong. We may not live to see that be the case. But what he thought and what looks like could be maybe the trajectory of things beginning now was that someday all the serious Christians who really want to serve God will find alternatives to the institutional churches. And then, of course, you'll find something more like what you had in Israel, really, throughout most of its history, where there was the whole nation were considered to be God's people, but there was a remnant within them who were really faithful to God. And as it says in Malachi, they got together with each other and spoke frequently to each other. And that may be what's going to happen in the churches. The church and its future is such a large subject. I can't really go into every detail of what things might change. And again, I'm not a prophet. I don't know which way things will go tomorrow or 5 years or 10 years from now. I do know that when God is finished with his work in the church, that the church will be unified and holy and mature, which are things that cannot be said about the church much at this point. Let's talk to Chris from Canada. Chris, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Good to talk to you again. Sorry I called you two days in a row. I hope that's okay.
That's unforgivable.
Oh, okay. Well, I better hang up then.
No. You got your foot in the door. Go ahead. Hi.
I'm good to hear from you. My question is today is regarding Romans 5:12-19. Mm. I was talking to one of my friends who told me that the death in verse 12 refers to spiritual death, because in verse 14 it says death reigned from Adam to Moses. Thus, if it were spiritual death, people would stop dying after Moses. But if it's spiritual death, then Paul clearly says we do not receive a sinful nature, since in verse 12 he writes that death spread to all men because all sinned. Now, my friend did note that it does not say because Adam sinned. He argues against Augustine, who said it meant all sinned in Adam. And then I asked him why babies still die, and he said because God kicked mankind out of the garden, so the tree of life was out of our reach. But that doesn't mean we still sin because we have a sinful nature, which is opposite to my view, at least the view I've always believed, is that we do have a sinful nature. And verse 18 seems to say that we do. So I'm just wondering if you could further explain this and sort of help me understand what Paul really meant when he said death. Was it spiritual or was it physical? And when he says that, you know, that death reigned from Adam to Moses, did that mean people stopped dying after Moses? Because that doesn't make logical sense either.
Well, it's a huge subject. And, I've heard some teachers say, and I would agree with them, that Romans chapter 5, verse 12 through 19 is probably one of the most obscure and difficult passages in all of Paul's writings to understand. And I thought so myself reading it as a youth, and then I was very, very relieved to find that a very knowledgeable Bible teacher, whom I really highly respected, when I heard him talk about it, he said that about it. He said, I think it's the most difficult, obscure passage in Paul's writings. In fact, he might have even said in the whole Bible, but it is obscure. It is a strange passage. Every line in it is ambiguous. Now, obviously, it means something, and no doubt there is a way to understand what it means correctly, but it's not a simple matter at all. And in fact, different theological camps are going to choose to read the ambiguity in light of their position, while others will read it another way. The interesting thing is that verse 12 is the only New Testament verse that Augustine used in introducing the doctrine of original sin. Now, before Augustine, the church fathers did believe, of course, that everyone sins. They did not ever explain why everyone sins, or, you know, they didn't talk as much, not clearly, about a sin nature. Augustine is the one who pretty much developed our understanding that sin was inherited from Adam and things like that. Now, you know, even before Augustine, everyone knew about Romans 5 and knew that Paul said that sin entered the world through one man, Adam, and death entered through sin also. But the latter part of verse 12 in the Greek says death spread to all men because all sinned. Augustine didn't read Greek. He only read Latin. And in the Latin Vulgate, it says death spread to all men in whom all sinned. In other words, the Latin says in whom all sinned, where the Greek says because all sinned. Now, the difference is this. Augustine said, reading it in the Latin and not in the Greek, that Paul is saying everyone sinned in Adam. In whom means in Adam, all sinned. Now, in the Greek, it doesn't seem like that, because it says death spread to all men because all sinned, because all have sinned. In fact, it's the same phrase used in Romans 3, which says for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, where it certainly is talking about individual sin. And he uses now two chapters later, because all sinned, death spread. So prior to Augustine, there was the idea that everyone certainly dies and everyone has sinned, and Adam had something to do with all that. But there wasn't the developed doctrine that we sinned in Adam and therefore are born guilty and we die because of that guilt. And so we are all more or less, I shouldn't say all, but most of us, I and most evangelicals have been more or less influenced by Augustine's contribution to this theological question. Whether it is a correct contribution or not is still debated. And I have to say, I still find it debatable. I don't know. I don't know if Paul is saying we sinned in Adam, which is what Augustine said because he was using the Latin instead of the Greek, or whether it just means we all sin somehow because of what Adam has done. We all do sin. But why would that be? And why would death enter? Now, your friend has a view that I have considered. I don't know if it's the right view or not, but I've considered it as a possibility. But not entirely. What I've suggested as a possible alternative, and I don't say this with conviction. I say this as a matter that I'm still very speculative about, is that it may be that we all sin because of Adam's sin, putting him outside the garden and out of fellowship with God. Now, when we sin, what are we doing? We're indulging ourselves. We're indulging our lusts. We're indulging our pride. We're indulging our greed. And these are things which we are supposed to resist. And presumably, Adam and Eve had the desire for things and for food and sex and all those things too, and self-dignity. I mean, things that become sinful for us were not necessarily always sinful, because Adam and Eve were not forbidden to do as many things as we are. But the thing is that when they sinned, they separated themselves from God by their sin. Before that, they walked with God. And therefore, even though there was perhaps always the opportunity to sin, including to eat the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, if they had stayed in close fellowship with God, which was in the garden where God met with them, they would have probably had the strength and the wisdom not to sin. But we have been born outside the garden. We are not born in fellowship with God. We have our lusts and we have our desires, but we don't have God in the same sense that they did, to strengthen us, to encourage us, to warn us, and so forth, in the same way that Adam and Eve did. And therefore, we don't have anything but ourselves to try to resist ourselves. And that's inevitably a failure. So we all sin. Now, as far as death is concerned, it's very possible that your friend is correct in saying that the reason all die is because the tree of life is no longer available to us. That was in the garden too. And because Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden and the way to the tree of life was barred from them and the rest of us, and we are all born outside the garden without access to the tree of life, therefore we, like they, have to die. And they themselves would not have had to die if they had eaten of the tree of the life, but they didn't. They couldn't afterwards, and therefore their natural mortality took over, and ours does too. Now, this is kind of, a lot of people would say this is Pelagianism. And I can't say if it is or not, because I don't know Pelagius, and I never talked to him about these things. But these are some alternative interpretations of these facts that sometimes have been presented. What I can say is I don't know that we have to understand the right view of this particular thing in order to be followers of Christ. It's a theological position that became very controversial in the days of Augustine and remains in some circles very controversial. But I don't see it as a... I don't see it presented anywhere in the Bible as a major doctrine that people have to understand to be saved or to be holy. And therefore, I don't worry about the details of it as much as some people do. And so it remains an unsolved mystery to me. I'm sorry I'm out of time for this section. We do have another half hour coming up. And for those of you whose radio stations carry it, we'll look forward to talking to you another half hour. For those of you who are leaving us right now, we are a listener-supported ministry. Go to thenarrowpath.com. And you'll find out how you can donate if you wish, or take things free from the website, thenarrowpath.com. Everyone who's staying with us, please stay tuned for 30 seconds. We'll be
right
back.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path. With Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We have another half hour together coming up. This is our second half hour of our daily hour-long program. If your radio station only carries the second half, or if you just caught us by accident at this point and didn't know there was an hour-long program, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. And one of the things you could do there is just listen to the whole program there. It is streamed from the website. Another thing you can do is not listen to it live, but listen to it from the archives as soon as it's posted after the show. We've got archives going back for years. Another thing you can do at the website is get the app. We have one for iPhone and we have one for Android phones, and once you have the app, you can listen to the program, the whole thing, and all the past programs and so forth from the app, from your phone, and then you never have to miss anything. The website, again, is thenarrowpath.com, and we now have one line open. If you'd like to call us, the number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Brad from Kuski, Idaho. Hi, Brad. Good to hear from you.
Hey, Steve. I'm calling about your statements about Jefferson yesterday.
Okay.
I think just about everything you said about him wasn't correct. Let me try to start here. Many times he called himself a Christian. Let me just name one. He wrote a letter in 1816 to Charles Thompson, where he stated to Thompson in the letter, "I am a real Christian, a disciple of his teaching." And he had a long correspondence with John Adams, where in later in his life, where many times he called himself a Christian. And then while he was president, the first term when he was president, he said that he believed the entire Bible, but he mostly concentrate on the morals, the code of morals found in the Bible, which leads me to some other things that you said that were incorrect. He didn't randomly write the Jefferson Bible. It was specifically, he was a student of philosophy, and specifically the philosophy of history and of government. And so he believed that the Bible and Jesus was the best moral philosopher in group and writings of philosophy on earth. And so he was writing that book, which he called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, not the Jefferson Bible. He wrote that book as a treatise to prove that the most moral person in history was Jesus. You understand that?
So are you telling me that he did believe in the miracles of Jesus, though they were not included in what's called the Jefferson Bible?
Yes. Now, I haven't studied. I'm a high school dropout, and I'm very ignorant, you know. But it's easy to study this stuff. I mean, I don't understand. I don't think you've read anything about Thomas Jefferson because.
No, I have not read anything from him. I've never read anything that he wrote, except I guess the Declaration of Independence.
But I think it's very important for when you make statements that you hear it, you read it firsthand. I mean, he's a very prolific writer, and he wrote a lot of stuff. Now, what he said was he wanted Benjamin Rush to write this book. In 1803, he wrote a letter to Benjamin Rush, asking Benjamin Rush to write this book because he knew that he would be attacked. Basically the way you attacked him. He knew that would happen to him because he was constantly being attacked by
I disagree with your characterization that I attacked Jefferson. I shared what I have read from critics of him, but I was not extremely critical of him more than to say that I believe he picked and chose in his Bible what to include and what not to include. But you're right. I haven't read the Jefferson Bible, or I haven't read his letters. I'm not a student of American history. I didn't bring up the subject. A caller asked me about the Jefferson Bible, and I shared what I had heard about it. And obviously, this is something I've never read. So now I've heard more. I've heard what you have to say about it. And so I have to say next, well, I've heard this from one source, and I've heard this other thing from another source. And unless I want to go and read Jefferson himself, which some people would find worth their time, I would not. I'll just have to remain, I guess, in the realm of ignorance about Jefferson, because I don't consider, you know, Jefferson's faith to be a matter of great concern to me. I believe that in history, there are a great number of influential people who either were Christians or called themselves Christians or were not Christians and didn't call themselves Christians, but whose actions are more substantial in terms of political outcomes than in terms of, what shall we say, the kingdom of God's fruit in the church. I'm not saying that it doesn't matter if Jefferson was a Christian or not. And if he was a Christian, praise God. I'd much rather believe he was. Frankly, I've never had a thing against Jefferson. I believe there's a lot of Christians in our founding. And there's a lot of non-Christians in our founding. But again, whether they were Christians or not has never been the issue with me because they're not church leaders. They are political leaders. It's sort of like I never cared whether Trump was a Christian or not, or whether George W. Bush was a Christian or not. Some people said he was. Some people said he wasn't. But to me, it's irrelevant. He's not a church leader, so it doesn't matter if he's a Christian. He's a political leader. And I'm not of the view that political leaders in the United States are required to be Christians. So, in other words, you say you're a high school dropout. I'm not much better. I didn't drop out of high school, but I graduated from high school early, and I never went to college. So I probably didn't spend much more time in high school than you did. The difference is, Brad, I know you, of course, you and I have known each other for decades now. You have been fascinated with things like American history, which makes you far more of an expert than me. I'm not fascinated with these details. So you're right. I assume you're right that I misspoke. I was not attempting to attack Thomas Jefferson. I was seeking to pass along information that I had read from what I assumed were credible sources. But once again, there's hardly anything about anyone in our history that isn't disputed by someone or another. So we've got, unless I want to do the research in the primary documents, I guess I just really don't know. And the difference between maybe me and you is that I don't really think I need to know. But it is true. I shouldn't attack people if I don't know what they said. And I certainly didn't consider myself to be attacking Jefferson. I was trying to answer a question, but if you saw it as an attack, then I will apologize for that. I certainly was not qualified to attack him or anyone else who founded the country.
Well, what I'm concerned with is exactly what Francis, who called you, was concerned with, and that is how this Jefferson Bible, as they call it, which he never called it that, is leading people astray. And so I'm not, you know, jumping on you for attacking Jefferson. I'm trying to say that so many Christians misrepresent Jefferson, which you did, which actually does lead people astray, because you have
It makes them think differently about Jefferson than they should. That's maybe true.
Yeah, so that's my only concern. Even I have many people who have attacked you to me, and I say, no, you're misunderstanding Steve. You have to listen to his own words, and I've listened to thousands and thousands of hours of your words, so I'm an expert on Steve Gregg, and so I can actually show people where they misrepresent you. I can show them. I can deliver to them via email your exact radio program and or teaching via MP3 on where you're different than what they're representing you as. And so it's the same thing is true with Jefferson. I think it's important for Christians to, if they don't know what they're talking about, not say anything. And if they do say something, to be willing to look at the opposite of view. And so
Let me ask you this. Do you know very much about Lincoln? I imagine you do.
Yes, Lincoln's my favorite president of the United States.
See, I heard a preacher, a Southern preacher, who was teaching a history course, say that Abraham Lincoln never claimed to be a Christian. Now, that surprised me, because I've heard Lincoln quoted as saying things about the Bible that were certainly respectful. In fact, I've heard quotes from Napoleon saying things about the Bible that were respectful, and Benjamin Franklin. Some of those men, I don't think, were Christians, but on the other hand, you say it misleads people. I don't want to mislead people about anything, on anything substantial or anything non-substantial. I don't want to be misleading on any point. But I think there are issues that when I repeat what I've read from some source that I feel knows more than I do about it, that they're not such important issues to me that I would feel like I have to go and research it to find out if what I've heard is correct. Because we're talking about people who are dead now. And, if somebody attacks one of my friends and misrepresents them, I will feel very obligated to defend them, because I feel like, well, this will impact their relationship. If they have a wrong view of this person, it'll impact their relationship. But I don't have a relationship with Lincoln or Jefferson or Napoleon or Benjamin Franklin. I can appreciate all of them in one way or another for certain things they contributed, not Napoleon so much, but, I mean, the founders of this country. But if I'm wrong about them, I don't really see that it has any impact on any relationship between me and anyone else, because I don't have that relationship with them. Yeah.
Well, think about this real quick. Quite often you've said that you believe that America should be a good society for your children. So that's the reason why I make it very personal to defend Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson and stuff, for the very same reason that you say that we need to have, you know, a good government for the sake of our children.
Okay, but I think we could have a great government even if these men were totally maligned, and I don't recommend maligning them, but I'm saying that even if everything that we heard about these men was wrong, we could still judge our present government on the merits of its policies based on what we as Christians believe. I mean, I don't want to see good men maligned. I certainly don't. But I'm saying for me to want good government for my children does not mean that I'm wishing for something that is somehow affected by their opinion of Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin, because if they had the worst possible opinions of those men, and maybe very unjustifiedly so, it would not have a direct impact on whether I believe or they believe necessarily that the government that we have right now is good, because after all, the government we have right now does not follow the philosophy of Thomas Jefferson as closely as I think it should. But whether Thomas Jefferson had those ideas or not, I have them, and no doubt I got them from him or from what was represented as his, to some degree. But I follow the ideas that I find in the Bible, and I judge governments by that. I don't judge it by their history. I mean, Israel, for example, had very good founders in Moses and, you know, the early King David and so forth. But that doesn't mean they were a good nation later on. So anyway, Brad, I can't take the rest of this time talking about that. I stand corrected. I appreciate always when you call to let me know when I've said something that's not accurate. It's almost always about politics or history. And
you know,
that's because those are not my field. Those are not my field.
You know, Steve, I can't call you for Bible questions because it's hard for me to actually call you. I get my answers from you when it comes to Bible stuff by just going to your MP3 files. So it is true. When I call you, it is something that I have to actually disagree with you on.
I know. Brad, you and I have been friends for a long time. By the way, folks, Brad and I fellowshiped together when we were in Idaho for years. And he was a good friend of mine, even when some people were not. It's always good to hear from you, and I'm always glad to learn something.
Well, you must realize that I do disagree with you almost every time you talk about government or history.
Yep. That's your field. That's not mine.
Okay. Bye.
All right. And that's why I try to stay away from it, unless someone brings it up. If I've heard or read from what seem to be reliable sources certain things, I don't mind passing them along. But I certainly don't claim to be an expert on things of most fields. The only thing I really know much about is the Bible, not much else. Let's talk to John from McMinnville. Hi, John. Speaking of people I've known for years, how you doing?
Oh, it's a different John.
No. Oh, well. No, there's only one John McMinnville, I know. No, there are more than one, but I know them all.
Yeah, first, second, and third John.
Yeah.
Well, so this is going to be kind of a potentially heavy subject. I'll try to keep things brief. I've been in flux with a couple of my views. I'm curious to run some stuff by you, present a view to you, tell me if you think I'm wrong, and if so, why. So,
you're wrong.
I called not long ago and shared with you how my model of the sovereignty of God has carried over into predestination of certain individuals to salvation. So, to keep it very simple, just to recap, God in his sovereignty chooses to allow history to take its natural course. There's a free will of men. He allows that. That's his sovereign choice, while reserving and exercising the right to intervene whenever he sees fit to order things according to his will, right? So,
okay, yeah.
Similarly carried over to predestination, there's a general call that is an authentic, genuine call. Come, whoever thirsts, come, let him drink, right?
Yeah.
So there's a general invitation to all men, yet it seems to me that God reserves and exercises the right to intervene into the lives of people and call them with a seemingly divine call. And by all appearance, it looks like predestination. But to say that he does, that he intervenes a couple of times, does not say that he intervenes at all times. Okay? So, and now, I'm looking at the foreknowledge of God. And those two things really make sense to me because, it to my way of thinking, it takes into consideration, it allows so much of the Bible to just say what it says without trying to shoehorn things in there. It's paradoxical, but it doesn't seem contradictory as well.
Right. I mean, sorry, you say you're looking at the foreknowledge of God, and then you said, and that explains what view of the foreknowledge of God is that you're saying that you're...
I'm sorry. What I was looking at was sovereignty and predestination, kind of carrying that over to foreknowledge. Okay, so historically I thought God just knows the future. He knows everything that's going to happen. Of course, a traditional view, and I felt comfortable with that. And I haven't felt any difficulty with the idea of, you know, as you know, some people are going to object to that and say, well, if God foreknew it, then that by default says that he ordered it, which just seems absurd to me because foreknowledge doesn't necessitate causation, right?
Right.
But there have been a couple of things that have been kind of a curveball to me with my traditional view of God knowing all of the future.
Okay.
Two things in particular, there are more, but two things in particular would be, one, God changing his mind And two, really the effects of prayer, if prayer actually does change things. Because if prayer changes things, that changes a lot, to my way of thinking. So this is oversimplified. I mean, it warrants an hour-long plus conversation. But in a nutshell, the idea that I'm courting now is this. Yes, God knows the future. And in so much as he has decided what he's going to accomplish. Now, I don't need that philosophically. Like I said, I don't think that foreknowledge necessitates causation. However, it just so happens that the things that he actually does know for sure will take place will be the things that he is ordering, the things that are his will, and that there are other things that he allows to take their natural course and to see. Now, he knows the possible outcome, but we have events where he says that for this reason I brought you into the wilderness so that I would know if you would obey me or not.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that there are some things that, for lack of a better term, I know they call it open theism, but for lack of a better term, it seems that there are some things that are very open, that some things in the future that he doesn't necessarily know about, but that he's open to.
Well, as you said, this would definitely warrant a discussion of more than an hour, which we don't have, and we have other calls too. But let me say, I've ceased to be alarmed by openness theology many, many years ago. I do not embrace openness theology fully. I believe the Bible does indicate that God knows what people are going to do, though I do not share the Calvinist view that he has foreordained everything that people do. But at the same time, verses like the one you quoted and many others, frankly, like that, do encourage an openness view of God. And I have a lot of friends, many of them I look up to, who take the openness view. Clark Pinnock took that view. He's one of my heroes. I didn't take that view myself, but I certainly admired him as a man of honest biblical scholarship. I have a number of living friends and pastors I know of that hold that view that I think highly of. I just haven't. To me, there's too many issues that I can't quite go there. It doesn't seem to answer all the scriptural data for me. But it doesn't bother me either. I'm not really sure what is impacted by it in my practical life. Now, one thing you did say that's perhaps the more unique thing about your views is that God sometimes has predestined a person here or there to be saved, that he doesn't predestinate everyone who's saved. He leaves that to free will. But there are cases, perhaps like Saul of Tarsus or like Moses himself and, even David, whom God has just decided before they were born, I've got a plan for you. Or he says to Jeremiah, I knew you when you're in the womb, and before you were born, I called you to be a prophet, and so forth. And Paul says that God, called me from my mother's womb. So certainly it could be argued that God predestined them to be saved. Although, of course, we could argue this too, that God knew that they would be persons who would be obedient to him, and therefore he chose them for the purposes that he chose them for. Arminian could say it that way.
Then there's his intervention in the matter, too.
Exactly, and his intervention, too. I mean, there's no question. I think Arminians in general have never had any problem believing that God has intervened to secure the salvation of some people to a degree that he hasn't intervened for everybody because he had a special call upon them, and I certainly agree with that. But my opinion is that Paul could have disobeyed the heavenly calling when he told Agrippa, I did not disobey the heavenly vision. I think he could have. I don't think there's much chance of it. I mean,
right.
Because the kind of man Paul was. You see, the Calvinists believe everyone is so anti-God by nature that it takes a real divine miracle to get someone to turn to God. Like, God is so unlovable that we could never love him unless he forced us to by an act of regeneration. I believe God's very lovable, and I believe that there's a great number of people, probably the majority of people, if God would reveal himself to them like he did to Saul or to Moses, they'd be on board, in other words, I don't think God had to predestine that they would get saved. I think what he predestined was he wanted them, and he intervened in their case in a remarkable way, and no big surprise, they responded well, like probably we might think most people would, but there would be some who would not, and even they could have chosen otherwise. But if they had chosen otherwise, I think God would have picked someone else.
Okay, so what do you think about this, though, to kind of fine-tune this a little bit? You said that you can't really receive all of open theism because it doesn't take into consideration all of the biblical data, and I'm tracking with you there. I understand what you're saying. Yet, what would prevent us from just letting each passage say its own thing? And they could be saying different things, like perhaps God really does, he really truly does know the future in these passages. These passages show it. Yet, the other passages seem to indicate that this area over here, he isn't exercising knowledge in that area.
Right. Well, if we're in fact, you know, taking things passage by passage and case by case, we can do that. But insofar as we're making general statements about God's foreknowledge, we can't make a general statement about his foreknowledge that is contradicted by another general statement. I mean, I leave it to the Calvinists to make general statements that contradict each other, like that God foreordained everything that would be done, and then he holds people responsible for it. I don't do that. My problem is, for example, Jesus knew that Peter would deny him three times before the cock would crow. Now, how did he know? I don't know how he knew, but he knew. And it was a guarantee that once Jesus predicted it, it was going to happen. Because if Jesus predicted it and it didn't happen, it seems to me that would make Jesus a false prophet. And that's not a possibility. Jesus knew it happened. Now, to say that God made it happen would mean that God made Peter sin three times, which I don't believe that God tempts us to sin. I don't think God is the author of sin. And that would make God the author of Peter's sin if God made him do it. And if God didn't make him do it and he was free to do something else, how did Jesus know it? But these are questions that the Bible doesn't answer. How did he know? I don't know, but I think it demonstrates that he did know. And so I'm willing to live with the mystery. But frankly, John, I really don't care if you get real interested in this subject and search it out and reach a different conclusion than me, because many Christians have. And it's one of those things I don't think is a front burner issue.
Well, I do think that there's a practical application to it, practical ramification, and that is really the effectiveness of our prayers. I mean, because...
Well, the Bible makes it very clear that prayers do change things, okay? Right. But so does getting up and going to work in the morning, or getting up and cooking an egg for breakfast. I mean, if God has predestined everything or foreknows everything, we might say, well, there's no sense not praying. And there's no sense in doing anything else either, because everything's going to happen just the way God knows it's going to happen. And no sense doing anything, because you're not going to affect outcomes. Now, to me, to say that prayer changes things is no more in conflict with the foreknowledge of God than to say that getting up in the morning and brushing my teeth changes my oral health. I think that prayer changes things in one way, by activating the hand of God in a situation, and working changes other things that we can do. But the real question is, why does anything we do change something? And how does that interact with the doctrine of God's foreknowledge? That is something that is a huge philosophical question. As you said, unfortunately, as you can tell, the music's playing and we don't have time to explore it further now. But John, keep up the search, and maybe you'll learn something I don't know yet. Maybe you already do know something I don't know yet. But anyway, good talking to you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener supported. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Everything there is free, but you can donate at thenarrowpath.com too. Have a good afternoon.